And we're back here on In Foul Territory. Anthony DiParadiso and George M. Gochner joined with David Krell, editor of the new book, The New York Mets in Popular Culture, which glosses over a number of topics regarding the baseball team from Flushing, Queens, including Casey Stengel, Dave Kingman, and more. Krell's love for New York baseball led him to write two other books entitled The New York Yankees in Popular Culture and Our Bums, The Brooklyn Dodgers in History, Memory, and Popular Culture. Krell is also the chair of the Elysian Fields chapter for the Society of American Baseball Research, also known as SABRE, which covers the North Jersey region. David Krell, welcome to the show.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Great. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
As you know, the Mets are still, they're not technically out, but they have been giving us one heck of a season so far, especially with Cespedes opting out. How are you dealing as a baseball fan and a Mets fan itself?
Well, this year has just been so chaotic in every single segment of society, so it's a little difficult to get used to seeing, and I'm not sure I'm still used to it, seeing games on television with no fans in the stands. There's something very strange and awkward about it, but I tune in when I can, and I hopefully by next year things will be back to normal.
Most definitely. So let's start out with Casey Stengel. So obviously the Mets started out poorly and were known as the lovable losers, and what kind of impact did the Mets instantly have in New York in the early 1960s?
Well, you have to remember that there was no National League team for 4 years. After the Dodgers and the Giants left, it was 58, 59, 16, 61. So when the Mets come in to the city in 62, there was this, you know, immense love and adoration. And a lot of that was because, guess what? Now Major League teams are going to be coming back to New York in the National League. They'll get to see Don Drysdale. They'll get to see Sandy Koufax. They'll get to see Willie Mays, these players that they loved in Brooklyn and New York. Now they're coming back. And that was a big part of the love and the excitement that happened around the Mets in that time.
Yeah, and also, being that they played in the Polo Grounds during their first couple of years, I mean, that definitely might have propelled the love even more.
Absolutely. You can't help but have a sense of history when you're going into the Polo Grounds in 62 and 63, as a lot of Mets fans from that time described it to me. But the Polo Grounds was fading. Ebbets Field was demolished. So there was a sense of, you know, there was a new era on the horizon with Shea Stadium and those cookie-cutter stadiums like Veterans Stadium and all those others that really came on the scene and were revolutionary. And then when Camden Yards was built, then we saw a reversal to the back, back to the past, as they say, where you only have baseball-only stadiums like in San Diego or Pittsburgh and other cities.
How's it going? It's Anthony. Thanks for coming on. So my question, if we want to skip ahead to the Mets getting to the World Series and winning it, the amazing Mets. Tom Seaver sadly passed away recently.
Yes.
What did he do not only for the Mets, but maybe for pitching as well, being somebody who knows about Seaver? Maybe you could shed some light on that.
Well, right before coming on to the show, I looked up Seaver's baseball reference page, and then I compared it with Clayton Kershaw, who I guess we can say is one of the best baseball pitchers in the last 10 or 15 years of the game. And in 1969, Seaver had 18 complete games. 18 complete games, and that didn't even lead the National League. And you compare that with Kershaw, who also won 3 Cy Young Awards, and Kershaw led the major leagues in 2014 with 6 complete games. So we've lost that art of pitching, and it's not the fault of the pitchers. There's so many substitutions. You guys go to the games, you watch the games, you're students of the game. You see that a manager might use 2 or 3 relief pitchers in one inning just for strategy purposes. So we've lost a lot of that magic. I think what Seaver brought was this boyish charm. He was the right image, beautiful wife, loved the game, just a tough competitor, a tough guy to hit off of. You know, you talk to people of that era like Rose or McCovey, before McCovey passed, you talk to Willie Mays, they'll all say Seaver was one of the toughest pitchers, right up there with Gibson, right up there with Koufax. I don't think he still gets enough credit because things like Sandy Koufax in Los Angeles dominating with those Dodger teams in the early 60s, Bob Gibson had that marvelous year in the late 60s. I think they lowered the pitching mound because of him. Seaver, I'm not going to say he gets overshadowed, but I don't think he gets sufficient credit.
Right, especially with pitchers during that era like Drysdale, Koufax. Koufax threw four no-hitters. That's something, you know, Seaver only threw one, and that was with the Reds. But I also wanted to talk about that really quickly, because I know when he was traded in 1977, that pretty much sent New York into a frenzy. And I remember watching the 1977 All-Star game, which was at Yankee Stadium in New York, and when Seaver was called by Bob Shepard, everybody in the stadium gave him a standing ovation, because that showed really what he meant to the city of New York.
Well, about that no-hitter, he said to Bob Costas, that wasn't even one of his top 10 games, as he considers his career, which is very, very interesting. When Seaver was traded, it was a definite blow. I was 10, and you have these four guys from Cincinnati coming in. Who's Pat Zachary? Who's Doug Flynn? Who are these guys? And you had to get used to them. And it's not like we didn't know that players got traded, because you're getting your baseball cards every spring, and players aren't in different teams. And in 77, Reggie Jackson came to the Yankees. That was big news. So we knew that this happened. It just didn't happen to us with a player of that caliber. It just didn't happen to the Mets with the franchise as he was known. So it was such a shock, and you guys know the story. Dick Young wrote an article about mentioned Nancy Seaver and how she was jealous of Nolan Ryan's wife because Nolan Ryan was the best paid pitcher in baseball. And there's a rule. You don't mention families in articles. You just don't. They have nothing to do with the game. And I think it's after that that Tom Seaver said, you know what, trade me.
Speaking of the 70s and the Mets, they started out early in the decade with Yogi Berra, and then they ended with Joe Torre, who was also a New York-born and bred baseball player. And what comes to mind instantly when somebody mentions the 1970s Mets?
Well, Matt Rothenberg wrote a great essay about the Mayor's Trophy game. And even though the Mets were not so great in those years between 77 and 83, there was still an affection. There was still an affection. And when the Mayor's Trophy game happened every June, they played the Yankees. It was a big deal in New York. It was fun to see the Mets and the Yankees play. This is way before interleague play. And that's what comes to me. And just watching, you know, in WOR, you didn't lose your affection for the team just because they had a few bad years. Then you're a fair weather fan. Then you have no loyalty. Then you have no connection to the team if you're just going to abandon them when they lose or when they're mediocre.
Matt Rothenberg is the former librarian for the Giamatti Research Center, which is a part of the National Baseball Hall of Fame. And you mentioned WOR, and speaking of all this broadcasting stuff, Bob Murphy, what significance does he play for Mets fans?
Oh, tremendous. Donna Halper wrote the essay about Murphy, and it's Murphy before he came to the Mets. He was a fixture in Boston and Baltimore, but he was known since 1962 as being the voice, the radio voice of the Mets until 42 years. And I remember watching Lindsey Nelson and Ralph Kiner on Channel 9, but Murphy was on the radio when you're taking trips down the shore, when you're running errands, when you're, you know, going out on for a night on the city and you're listening to Bob Murphy, you know, call the game as you're driving. That was just the background of your life as a Mets fan.
I'd just like to get into what you think the Mets' main appeal is to their fan base and to New York, being that you have the Yankees there as their foil.
Well, I wouldn't say the Yankees are their foil. I know what you mean, and I think I know where you're going. I think the Yankees still dominate the headlines, even though it's almost 60 years later since the Mets were formed. I think the Mets always have this underdog quality to them, this working class quality to them. That's always been there. It also depends on the decade. If you talk about the 80s, well, Paul Hensler wrote an essay about the swagger of the Mets, but that was really a product of its time. Because I had a discussion with Paul, I said, take it further. What were the 80s about? Brashness, lifestyles of the rich and famous, hosted by Robin Leach, Dynasty, Dallas topping the Nielsen ratings for television programs, Gordon Gekko, that famous character that Michael Douglas portrayed in Wall Street, saying greed is good. There was a real swagger and brashness about the 80s aside from the Mets. So they really fit with that decade. And if you're talking about the 69 Mets, well, here are these underdogs out of nowhere defeating Baltimore. Every better in the country, every odds maker, every news writer, every sports writer, every broadcaster had the Orioles winning. And the Mets won in five. It was this great boost for the city and a great lesson. And that's why I dedicate the book. I used the caption from the movie poster Working Girl. And it says, for anyone who's ever won, for anyone who's ever lost, and for everyone who's still in there trying. And I can't tell you the amount of people who have come back to me and said how that describes being a Mets fan. It's an up-and-down existence. But, you know, you stick with your team, whatever your team is.
Yeah, definitely. And I know in the 80s, one channel would be Who Shot JR, and another channel you're watching the Mets play at Shea Stadium. And I wanted to talk about 1986
sure.
really quick, because being that they made it to the World Series, they beat the Astros in the NLCS against Mike Scott and Jose Cruz. And I know that you experienced that World Series. What do you remember most about that year?
Shock. When the ball went through Buckner's legs. Absolute shock. I don't think I moved for about 5 seconds. I couldn't believe that such a simple error happened with a game on the line. And you'll recall that the screen on the scoreboard said, "Congratulations, Red Sox." And there's footage, I think it's on YouTube, where the NBC broadcast team was in the Red Sox locker room. All the plastic was down to cover the lockers, because they expected champagne to be sprayed all over the place. And they ushered that champagne out very quickly. Once Ray Knight crossed home plate, they hustled out of there like they were on fire. And I just remember absolute shock. But then realizing, okay, they still had to win Game 7. Kind of like the Miracle on Ice. The U.S. beats the Russians. They still had another game to play. So it's not like it was a given, but the momentum was there. And you felt, okay, you got to believe. Never say die. We have one more chance to get it right.
Yeah, and given the team that they had during that time, Doc Gooden, Daryl Strawberry, Howard Johnson, I mean, that brings back a lot of memories for Mets fans.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Gooden on the mound in his rookie season of 84, it was a resurgence. It was a true shot of adrenaline that, hey, you know what? We could be good again. We could be great again. And then Strawberry with his home runs and just a good mixture of personalities on that ball club. And Keith Hernandez, Gary Carter, Hernandez had the leadership quality. He made them believe that they were, not better than they were, but the way that I hear him tell it and the way that I hear others tell it, he made them believe that they were professionals, that this was an absolute privilege to play. And you had to meet a certain quality, not just on the field, but your whole attitude. You can't just, you know, go work out whenever you want. This is a team, and you have to sacrifice for the team.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of home runs, I know Dave Kingman, who also hit towering home runs for the Mets. And I wanted to know, what impact did he have on the Mets as well as Mets fans?
Well, he was pretty much the only bright spot during that time in the late 70s. And he was my favorite player. We shared the same name. We shared the same initials. So every time he came up to bat, you thought, hey, you know what? There's a 50-50 chance that he's going to hit the ball over the fence. And one of the very few bright spots, if not the only bright spot for Mets fans after the Seaver trade.
Oh, it's most definitely. And also, especially since Shea Stadium was a pitcher's ballpark, so it was most likely hard to hit a ball out of Shea Stadium.
Oh, you're so right, George. Absolutely. And look, if Kingman had played on the Yankees I know he played a handful of games, but if he had played on the Yankees in 77, 78 for an extended period of time, if he had played on contenders, he'd be in the Hall of Fame. There's no doubt in my mind. If he had a World Series ring, he'd be in the Hall of Fame.
Last question before we go to break. I wanted to ask you about just overall the process of editing this book. What was going on when you were editing it? Overall, how do you feel about this book being published?
Well, I feel great. I had a great team. Everybody came with their A game. They took us down avenues I didn't even know existed. If you write, let's say you're writing a chapter about Dave Kingman, it's going to be different than the chapter I'm writing. It's going to be different than the chapter that Charlie Vassallero contributed. So you got a real diversity of approaches and fresh angles on well-known topics and some little-known topics. So I was very glad to have a chapter on Casey Stengel, but equally glad to have one on Rheingold Beer, the first Mets sponsor. I was very glad to have an essay that I contributed on Sports Phone and interview Howie Rose, because that was Howie's first job in sports broadcasting. So Sports Phone was a telephone service, a pay-per-call service in the 70s and 80s, and it was a very big deal, especially in New York. So I wanted to have that represented and talk about some random Mets games and Mets news stories that happened during that time that you might have found out if you dialed into Sports Phone. So I feel very, very good. The Yankees book that I edited was a lot of fun, but you pretty much know you're going to get a chapter on Mantle, on on the 70s with Reggie Jackson, Billy Martin, on the stadium, on Babe Ruth, and so forth. But here, the Mets have such a colorful history that they had carte blanche to do whatever they wanted as long as we tied back to the Mets. Jermaine King wrote about the Mets and hip-hop, and I said, don't you mean the Yankees and hip-hop because of Jay-Z? He said, no, the Queens has as strong as a connection as the Bronx or stronger to hip-hop. So there was a real big range of topics that we had to choose from, and I feel great, and I'm internally grateful to the contributors, because people are coming to me saying, you know, great job, and you must be proud, but this was by no means a solo project. By no means did I do this alone. They really, really dug deep into the granular, and I think any Mets fan and any baseball fan, quite frankly, will benefit and enjoy this book.
Yes, and I'm certainly looking forward to reading it. So it's The New York Mets in Popular Culture. It can be pre-ordered now on Amazon. David Krell, thank you so much for coming on the show and being so kind.
Thank you.